Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising podcast. It's me, your host, your friendly Geordie software developer, Sam Hogarth, and with me I have the literal Motley Crue of Motley Crues. We have the wizard of the party, Jay Hersko. How are you doing, Jay?
Morning.
Or afternoon, where I am. We have the party bard, Chris Merman. How are you doing?
I'm happy to be here.
Just happy to be here. We have our party ranger. I'm going to guess it's Andrew Leff.
Yes, good to be here.
I thought he was
happy
like a mage.
Friday, everybody.
I want to hear what he called Franz. Wait, let him keep going.
Yeah, he'll keep going. He's got a bit.
I've got a bit. And our party rogue, Franz, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. I was hoping I'd get balanced up against a charisma stat, but I'll take dexterity if I have to.
Franz, the king of the pre-show.
I know, all the fun bits don't get recorded, right?
That's right.
So today we're talking about lust, one of the seven deadly sins, and how it applies to agile development. This is where we find out that for the last 15 years, I've been doing agile development wrong.
I am most curious. I am, of all the sins, I am really curious about how this is going to go. Doing research, it scared the crap out of me.
Honestly, we can thank Sam for this entire episode, right? Because so we've been doing this series, and Merman, you admitted later, you were like, I had no idea how we were going to work lust in. For those that aren't on the Discord, Sam posted something in one of our chats about we don't apply management concepts from the 50s correctly, let alone anything modern, right? That was Sam's remark. And then I was over-caffeinated early one morning, and I went back with, yes, Sam, and the reason is because perversion. We pervert things. And my theory, which I'm now Franz is waiting to jump in because he said, Jay, you said this like six different channels, five different ways. Someone comes up with an idea. It's something that's applicable. It starts spreading. And then the people who want to help that idea thrive and spread even further, they pervert it. They pervert it. They smooth the rough edges, right? Because they want to try and reach a larger audience. And they try and make it look like something that's already out there. And then from there, the more you shave and the more you pervert it, the farther away it gets from what you were actually trying to do to begin with. And then it can again be manipulated and all that. And then it, you know, sociopaths run wild. And then, Franz, you actually threw something back, I think, where you said not just perversion, but also corruption, right? A different way to look at it.
I think it really comes down to two things. You know, if we're gonna use the lexicon of lust, right? It really comes down to two things where you'll have perversion where I really like agile. But I don't work in an environment where we can do sprints. So maybe we could just pick up stories dynamically and we'll do Scrum Bond. And something like that you could see is more of just a straight perversion, right? But then you can also see it come down into the corruption part of it, where I want to say I'm doing Agile, but I have Scrum and then I do everything in Waterfall and I do massive planning sessions and we don't work for the first 6 months because we're really trying to get a good idea of what we're doing. And so the delta between trying to twist it for what you do, so perverting it so that it fits in your particular lane, is very different from my boss said we're going to do agile, but I don't want to change our methodology. And so we're going to call what we're doing agile, despite it sharing nothing similar. We're not going to do regular releases. We're not going to do iterations. We're not going to be modifying our process over time. We're just going to come in and say, yep, we're agile now, even though not a single bit of our process matches. So I would argue that's where you start seeing the delta between perversion and corruption.
Yeah, and I want to say yes, and sorry for my voice this morning. I'm suffering with the flu. To me, when we dip our toe into that water, right? So let me challenge the group. How does this resonate? Lust, that challenge, that perversion, this desire to move faster. Organizations start to lust for this fiction of speed when they don't know how fast they're going today. So they lust after it. They put all their eggs in this basket. They hire a bunch of people to come in to sell them agile, and they're lusting for this fiction of this speed that may or may not be within the organization already. They may be moving too fast to even understand at what speed they're going. So there's a lust or desire for this kind of perverted or perversion of speed, right? Speed could really be a challenging indicator for an organization to understand. And you know, based upon somebody's bonus at the end of the year, that could create that lust bubble.
You know, it's funny that you say that, Lef. As we've defined things before, like in my attempt to like find what I thought was the definition of the sin that kind of appropriated Beth, is that every single definition that resonated described the desire as unnatural, right? And the word immoral is used a lot, and I don't want to get into a morality play because that's stupid, but there is this sense of like, when you want something in an unnatural either order or manner, that, I mean, that describes better, faster, cheaper that we've been dealing with for the last 15 years, you know?
And it creates blinders, and I'll let the rest of the panel speak, but it does. I feel lustful qualities create blinders that don't allow you to read the signs and signals within the organization to understand all the information that we need to account for when making change, right? And change, can lust shut down the ability to change because of what you just said, Merm? Are we so focused because we're so lustful that we have those blinders on, that we're so locked in that we can't see anything else around us? We're just locked in on that.
Exactly. And when I was doing a little bit of research for this, I turned off Google Safe Search just to make sure I get the accurate results. And what I found from that was, the important thing about lust is it's the desire. Obviously, there is a lot of the morality stuff behind it, especially with the biblical and the pre-biblical origins of some of the words that became lust or defined by it. And the blinded by aspect of it is really important to me. You see this a lot with agile transformations, buying off the shelf stuff. I'm on the record of saying, like, I think there's some good stuff in Safe, for example. I don't want to bash Safe, but it is a product that is something you can buy off the shelf as here's a starting point for an agile transformation. I've worked in companies that have done that and then have said, we're agile now, because we've implemented a new framework. I see it in some sense as kind of keeping up with the Joneses. People recognize the market has moved, the management methodologies or whatever you want to call them are different now to what they were, and we need to be seen to be doing these things. The lust is in a sense, you're desiring something that you are not, and you are taking shortcuts in some way to get there or to be able to be perceived in that sense.
I'm curious, like, around that, again, the word unnatural just keeps popping up in my head. So I'm curious from you all's perspective, like Jay and Franz, like, what are, like, in your mind, what is unnatural feel like that to you all that you've experienced? I mean, because I think feel like everybody's gonna have a different definition, and I don't know that there's a wrong thing that fits in this category. It's just that, again, I'm still stuck on, like, what does it mean to want something in an unnatural way?
I think it flirts with the it's I think it becomes unnatural when two things occur. One, it is obsessive. Like, you can come in there and you can realize we can keep going down this path. It will very likely not work. And you, that little voice is going off in your head. You go, no, I'm right. I know this is how it's going to work. We're going to do it this way. And oh my goodness, what was the second one I was going with? Oh man, I totally forgot where I was going with that.
Right.
But it's, yeah, it's when it starts hitting an absolute obsession for it, where you are willing to see that things are not working. And when everybody around you is saying it's not going to work, you just keep pushing forward. So it's this. Yeah.
It's that almost unnatural desire, right? That implacable, or that's even a word, the unimplicatable desire of, I need this thing, I want this thing. I've convinced myself that this is what I want, what I need. And, you know, the way the universe works is, if you really are convinced that this is the thing and you want and you need this, right, heaven and earth will move to align that way, but it will align in a way that's not, you know, unintended consequences. And when I apply this to the A word, right, the agile thing with the company, heard that, oh, well, twice the work in half the time, right? We could do a whole episode on just pulling apart that statement. But somebody hears that, and why would you not want twice the work in half the time? Why would you not want to be able to call yourself agile, right? So you get blinded by the thing. And it ties to, I think Sam was poking at it, and Franz was as well, your mental model, your opinion of this is what this thing is. And then you desire it above everything else without really thinking about what is going to go into getting to that place, right? Like, I mean, it's yeah, where the, you know, the trope of the, you know, the old trite remark of the rubber meets the road, right? That's I think all of us can say that a lot of these companies, they have nothing but the best of intentions, where, yeah, we'd like to move quicker, we'd like to create some throughput, you know, get some value to the customer faster, but at what cost? And I don't think they ever stop to say, here I go, I'm going to quote Dr. Malcolm, right? You did so much time thinking about that if you could do something, that you never stop to think about if you should, right? Like, that was a terrible Jeff Goldblum impression, by the way. Somebody's coming after me after that.
Who's letting him do voices?
Great. Good job.
So, what you're getting around to is, like, the unnatural thing, it's always what someone else does that the desire leads to the unnatural, right? So, like, for business, all they want is for delivery teams to be able to look at the work that they're being asked for, tell them exactly when it's going to be done and exactly how much it's going to be cost, it's going to cost, and don't deviate, and we'll be fine. And for teams, all they want is business to just decide what they want, make up their mind, communicate it clearly, don't ever change their mind. And for scrum masters and project managers, we unnaturally think everybody should just get along while we have this conversation. So everybody wants something that is unnatural, and then we're pissed when it doesn't go smoothly.
See, the way I say unnatural in this regard is it's a desire for something, someone, so some kind of feeling, typically pleasure in the traditional definition, but let's call it satisfaction or a feeling of excellence or whatever. But it's something that you either can't or shouldn't have. And I see this with developers quite a lot. I feel like I've done it myself. You know, we watch talks, we read books about, you know, how the FAANG companies work at planetary scale, and we think that's how we should be doing stuff, not whether what they're doing is appropriate to our context. We could absolutely take some learnings from it, but we shouldn't operate like Facebook because we're a bank. They're two different things. And you know, the fact that they can deploy to production every 4 seconds or whatever is great and technically makes me purr, but that's not where we are, and it's not where we perhaps even need to be. Right. And if I pursue that excellence as some kind of factual milestone of this is where we should be because it is the right thing to do, and I prioritize that ahead of our team's immediate priorities or the economic climate our company is operating in, that kind of stuff, that's where I, as a participant on that team, have been corrupted, have been perverted, and am now no longer acting in the interests of that team.
Maybe that's one of the big perversions we can bump into as well. I think this is valid, and therefore this is our highest priority. I realize it runs counter to our deliverables, but I internalize my wanting to get deliveries done. Let's say you work for a company where you release once every 4 or 5 months. If you spend 6 sprints trying to go in there and make it so you can deploy with a single push of a button, that's a terrible utilization of resources. But, you know, your idea of, well, that's what Fang does. And, well, that's what I worked for one company, and that was our standard, was that it really comes down to a lot of the coaching or management work that we do needs to be focused on what is the best. I have 6 widget producers. What are the best widgets for them to produce this sprint? And perversion is when we stop looking at it in that kind of way and start going, ooh, well, I saw a blog post where Facebook rolled out a new AI deployment tool that makes it so that when they have one of their 5,000 development streams, they can get it done in 2 seconds. And we should spend $10,000 making it so our one branch and environment has this exact same tool so we can deploy in 2 seconds instead of 45 minutes.
Yeah, there something you just said, Franz, it's, does lust create this perversion of thought towards what the end state should be, right? So I used to get in trouble, right, when I was consulting, because I would say the goal is never to be good at Agile. Right? That's never the goal. You should never want to be good at Agile, right? We want to be better at accommodating change, and Agile helps us understand how to do that. So with that being said, when we're so lustful towards something, we all keep bringing up a couple different areas within large organizations, right? And I love the, you know, we're not Facebook. Right. So what are we as a bank? What does Agile mean? How agile can we be? How much faster can we deliver? Or how much more consistent with a higher level of quality can we be lustful about? So does lust start to distort or create a perversion of what the end state could be because we're so locked in on getting somewhere to be better at Agile, maybe? I don't know. I'll throw it back to the panel.
One last thing on that.
Go on.
I think there's a little bit of a fear element to it, though. So, like, if we're always worried we're not following standards, and I'm talking beyond like the cargo cult, the Agile manifesto says to do A, B, and C, so we have to do A, B, and C. But I think, like, Sam and I work in the develop, you know, we're actual developers, right? So, like, we're writing out code, and we're able to stop it. We're able to contribute to the health of a project. And there are a lot of health indicators that are really valid. So it's like, I want to make sure that my code always has the right spacing and it does this and it's readable and everything. But if I'm spending an exorbitant amount of time trying to keep and reach those standards, is that the best thing for the client? Is that the best thing for the project? And I think there's a fear that if I don't do this the standards way, if I don't have it so everything's camel case and this and that, it's not going to work. But if I keep rejecting PRs, and Andrew and Sam, you and I have gotten into the whole rejecting PRs for stuff like that. Am I benefiting the client in that position? Am I making sure the project runs better by saying no? And that's something I know I've definitely had a hard time in. Like, is this the best way to present this, or the best way to make sure the project is successful over the term of the contract instead of just now? And I think that's, we get scared and then we really aggressively chase after, no, camel case. We're going to do this. We're going to have this spacing. Send it back. Right. Do it again. Spend another 8 hours.
What Sam was saying, right, about, okay, well, it's great because Facebook can do that, but we're a bank. Do we need to do that? I think a lot of the technological advancement that we see does come from the lust of, hey, that idea sounds cool. We should do that. And the example I would give you is cloud infrastructure. I've read tons of books on cloud infrastructure. I'm not an engineer, but I think I understand it fairly well. And the biggest thing I take away from it is massively, woefully complex. Massively, woefully complex. And you really need someone who knows their shit in order to help build it, configure it, make it safe, make it secure, get it out there. And you have you have a lot of companies, right? A lot of us have worked banged around enterprise level organizations, right? 30, 40, 50, 100,000 people. They're chasing after this thing. And part of you wants to, you come to the point where you stop and you want to say why. You want to say why? Why do we want that? And when Merman was talking before, I came up with this picture in my head, right? So tying all these sins together.
Uh-oh.
In the middle you have lust, gluttony, and greed, right? That's a triangle. Those three things are driven by pride and envy, right? I need to deploy five times a minute. Sam can deploy five times a minute. So you have pride and envy feed your lust, your gluttony, and your greed, which creates sloth, which creates wrath. We haven't done wrath, have we? Have we done wrath?
We did wrath.
We did wrath.
Wrath was one of the first ones.
So Jay, I'm going to give everyone something for free because I'm terrible at making money. What you just said would be a phenomenal exercise in the boardroom. The deadly sins of organizations. Let's map it right now. Let's start putting stickies within the organization as far as where we're too lustful, where there's wrath, right? You're actually talking about mapping the culture of an org and talking about culture change, which could be lustful, right? We're so lustful to change culture, yet we're not going to change the culture. So that again, it becomes a goal, but culture just, I used to love that as a consultant. Hey, come in 8 weeks. We want our culture changed. Oh, okay. Yeah. Perfect. Right. Like give me a magic wand and a wizard hat. So it's frustrating and mind boggling at the same time that we lust for certain things. Right. But in reality, what grounds us to the reality of what is feasible and how aggressive do we need to be and disruptive? Right. So how do we lust for disruption and use disruption as an ally within that course, right? Like, how do we partner? You hear me say it all the time in these. How are we in relationship with these emotions or sins in a different way than we are today to ensure that we're not falling in the same traps of the status quo, what we've done to get ourselves here to date? Sorry, Chris.
No, that's a really good idea.
Yeah, let me word it a slight different way than left than what you said, but I'm with you and I want to follow you down this path. So this idea of misuse of things, right? Like in Judaism, they have this phrase called Yetzer Hara. I'm probably mispronouncing it, but it is not a. It's not necessarily like a demonic force like describing lust, but it's more of it basically describes a person's misuse of things, which the physical body needs to survive, and is often contrasted with like there's another phrase, which is basically like the positive version of that. But like, so again, there's all cultures have this way of describing things of like, these are things that you need. These are basic things. The only problem is that when you get 10 people together and we say, hey, what is a misuse of things that we need to survive? You will get 25 different answers and nobody will agree on which one, right? Which is why, again, the unnatural things that we want have to do with what someone else does. Because when it comes to what we want, we know what's natural to us. This makes sense. This keeps me from working nights and weekends. This doesn't, overuse our people and our resources and stuff, right? But as soon as it comes into someone else's field, they're like, what's wrong with working an extra 5 minutes, Merman, if it means production stays up over the weekend, right? Like that's, again, this thing of what's natural and a misuse of it. It like, we can't ever agree on it. Like that's what's the unnatural part of it. It's thinking that we're all going to agree. You know what I mean?
So let's ground ourselves. And so every vice has a virtue. Yeah. What I struggled a bit actually trying to differentiate gluttony, greed, and lust, the core triangle of Jay's map of hell. I'm worried that if you do draw that on a whiteboard, you may summon the Chaos Gods, Slaanesh. So,
Chaos Gods, Dave Snowden shows up and hits me in the face with like a smelt or something.
You know? I actually put thought about this in advance. So if we think about what are those three desires, right? Like Sam, the idea of greed is a lust for like riches. Thanks. Because with money, right? Becomes status, becomes power, becomes whatever, right? Wanting something that gives you a better life, right? Gluttony is things that I take into my body, right? That I have an unnatural desire for. Lust is a physical thing. I want that, right? Like I like pick whatever dumb thing you think of. Like Lef has biceps that I just can't possibly like create in a weight room. And it's just because we have different body types. But for me to be like, I need guns like Lef's, like that's an unnatural thing because it's just not gonna happen.
And the virtue that I found to oppose lust is probably poorly named, but chastity. Or to some degree, restraint. And I think that is the important thing about kind of grounding that lustful feeling and understanding when am I beginning to get a bit irrational about what I'm feeling or what I'm wanting the organization to do. Chastity, I guess monogamy is probably the biblical perspective on it. But yeah, I found that one really interesting to see as a difference, this kind of like over excess of pleasure and hedonism and all that kind of stuff against moderation, to some degree temperance, restraint.
I like the usage of the term temperance because it ties back to what me, you and Franz were talking about early on, right? When we were talking about the lust for greater pay, right? And some, you know, when you want more money, sometimes you have to jump ship. And we have all come across people in our careers who the check is the motivator for them. They're chasing the check. Like they're lusting after more money. And that is their primary motivator. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I think most of us would agree that we've also met people who were in their constant chase for a bigger check have really made themselves kind of miserable and even painted themselves into corners where they're not happy people. Like, you know, we all know the desire for the thing trumps the actual thing. You know, yeah. I want this. When you finally get it, that's fleeting. And then you want something else, right?
To be fair, you're still describing greed. Like, I just want, there's some people listening in the audience that are saying like, you lust for more money. Like, no, that's greed. Like, so again, we need to be very clear. I'm not
maybe, 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 but I think Jay's touching on an interesting point. Yeah. When we're lustful, does that prohibit us from like this urge, right? It's just this urge to so I equate it to teenagers, right? I don't know if anybody here has teenagers. I do.
Interacted with one or two.
When they're in full lust, the world around them is non-existent.
I understand.
Right? They are so locked in on what they're lusting for. It does not allow us to desire anything different. So how are we harnessing that kind of, and I loved, Sam, when you used the word hedonism, right? Like it creates this hedonistic quality of, I want a consumer, but anybody that lusts for agile transformation is insane. There's a hot take for you, is insane, right? Like you're crazy. It is extremely painful. It is extremely grueling. And you need such a consistent level of alignment, discussion, openness, trust, honesty, all the things that make for a good relationship. So I want you to also keep that in the back of your brain. What is a good relationship with lust, right? Or transformation. So how are we using these signals of too much lust, too much greed, too much, you know, whatever, all the sins, right? Too much of anything is not a good thing. Too much of agile isn't a good thing, right? You can't go full agile. Never go full agile, right? We'll quote
Tropic Thunder.
Tropic Thunder. So any case, I know I'm going off on a little bit of a tirade.
I love following y'all when y'all go down these trails.
I know. I think one of the problems is we're taking a spicy word like lust and we're going, now how does this relate to the workplace without any of like the obvious indication, right? I would say though, in the context of what we do with work, I'd say the virtue in it is not necessarily chastity, but I'd say it's dedication. Because what we see a lot, or what we've gone over a lot with lust here, is that it is this It is the what the perverse obsession with something, or the unhealthy obsession with getting something. I mean, that's Leff brought it up so well with the teenagers. Is no, there is. I need to see Sandy. That is the only thing in the world right now is getting to Sandy's house, and I'm completely blinded against everything else. And the healthier version of that would be dedication. So it's not, we need to have the best deployment so that we can go on par with Facebook, even though we're a 5-man mom and pop. It's, we need to make sure we get our projects done as efficiently as possible in a way that works for everyone. And that's our dedication to it. And it's allowing it, we need to put ourselves in a position where we are regularly, I mean, that's why we have our sprints and our retros, is we are regularly iterating over our process, and you're going, does it continue to make sense for us to modify our CI/CD to be faster? Do we need to make it so that we have 2 demos every week so that we can properly show off, so somebody in the boardroom doesn't get skittish? It's, we need to put ourselves in a position where we're asking ourselves, over the last 2 weeks, we did this. How do we make it? How do we identify what on those 2 weeks was valuable? And we're not going to lust after the waterfall goal we set 6 months ago. We're going to keep trying to improve our process. And I think it's that it's the dedication to doing better that's the most important, not the dedication to having the best demo every week. It's finding what's the, it's cutting off the gristle and find, you know, getting the meat. What is the thing that we're delivering? Are we delivering the FANG deployment process, or are we delivering a really good product every 4 or 5 weeks? Because that's all the client cares about and needs.
As agilists, as techies, I think we're always going to have that desire to do things better, to be more resilient, to build tech that doesn't fall over every day, all that kind of stuff. I think that's innate in us, that desire to do better. But yeah, it's the aspect of knowing when to have the fight, knowing, choosing your battles, basically, not laboring points that will perhaps not act in the immediate interests of the team.
So let's point the, real quick, Chris, let's point the flashlight on us, right? So as coaches, developers, or people that have experienced the agile, you know, the capital A agile, do coaches come in with too much lust?
Yes.
Right? As a coach, are we too lustful for what we think can happen because we've seen it? So do we get blinded by the greatness that we've seen and experienced and become too lustful to understand that it's just not one size fits all? Sometimes companies just can't get there in the amount of time we expect.
I would argue the problem is that most haven't seen it. They've just been told it's possible. And so they're just repeating what someone else told them. And
right. Which creates lust, right, for experience, yes, at that point.
You know what's unnatural? Wanting something you've never seen. Right. Like, well, there, this is why two pizza teams, this is why two pizza teams work. Like, okay, have you seen a 3 pizza team work? Does that disprove your theory? Like, I don't know. How about a 1 pizza team? Is that like, why are we measuring teams in pizzas? Like
how big is the pizza? There's a place down the road from me.
Exactly. Is this a shakaroni, or, you know, are we talking a personal pan? Right. Like, So I listened to this podcast on productivity the other day. It was this guy talking with Adam Grant. He's a software developer who's now become a productivity guru, right? And he says, like, and this guy's like, he's like, all the productivity hacks, like 4-day work weeks, the you know, the no meeting Fridays, the, you know, the no meeting half days, or Pomodoro, or any other hack that you can zero inbox. Do you know what none of those things solve? When organizations put too much on their people's plate and they can't effing decide what's number one in priority and what's the most important thing to do. And let's throw this is a reasonable amount of work to ask for. No productivity hack will fix that. No. And I mean, Leff represents the biz now. Like, Leff knows, like, he's, the stuff being told of him with the amount of people that he has to get done is not possible. And he says it every single time. They look at him and they smile and pat him on the head and they say, get back out there, Skippy, because you know, you need to do that, right? We as agilists, we hear if people that still refer to themselves somewhat as coaches, like, your business wants too much. and technology can't get it done, and you're trying to balance out in between. Like, there is no hack to fix. We are putting too, we want more than what we really have, and there's no framework, there's no methodology, there's no set of principles that will fix a business, especially here in the US, where we need more and we want it any way we can, no matter what. You know, I still get confused. Jordy or Jody's, one of the two. Jordy. Whatever, how you, Jordy. It doesn't matter. It's better than I don't know what it is at this point in time. Like whatever Sam, it's in your world. Like it, like we cannot have like temperance. Like it, there is no hack that fixes a lack of temperance. And that's a human condition that is not curable.
I want to throw the baton to Franz because he looks like he's geared up to say something. But first, I want to yes and back to what Lef was saying, where he was turning the mirror on us, right? Are we too lustful? First, I'm going to quote Mike Tyson, right? Everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face. And a lot and it's not that we're bitter on this call or we're cynical. I would argue we're seasoned and experienced. And we've seen
Franz definitely is.
When you walk in and you say, hey, I'm Andrew Lef, and I'm going to give you Agile for $49.95, right? We know that we've seen what these organizations can do. And if I'm truly turning the mirror on myself earlier in my career, and a lot of practitioners that we know and we see all over some of the social media sites, is we suffer from, if I had to diagnose us as a whole, we suffer from unrealistic expectations of reading too many books and taking too many classes. And a lot of us are highly educated, highly well-read, highly well-written. And we have all these ideas. And to your point, Merman, like the two pizza team. And as soon as you said that, then Sam started in, you know, I got a place that serves 30-inch pizzas. Lef knows the Jersey Shore. They make those Wildwood pies, right? Which are like 4 feet across. So again, we have these ideas of, oh, well, this is how it should work. I'm going to go help Franz make it work this way. And then we show up and Franz's organization, his culture is antithetical to what we're trying to do. And yet we're almost Don Quixote. We're almost Don Quixote.
So picking up what Lef said, as I'm sure you've noticed, I've been picking on CICD that Sam laid down earlier. And one of the reasons I keep bringing that up is I have spent the last 4 weeks rebuilding the CICD process at where I'm working right now. And I was getting ready to start into a new sprint where I'm like, okay, there's these 6 cool widgets. We could totally make those part of our standardized CICD process because that's what the guy who created the software does. And now we're having this talk and I'm like, but does it matter? Do we need those 6 little additions to our CICD process? We got all the good stuff and there's one or two other really like, there's two other like code health things that would be good, but do I need to spend another 2 weeks of my time rebuilding the CICD process when everything we have works really, really well? Or the stuff we have down the chute works really well? And it's, we need to be dedicated to improving, but we got to make sure we don't just want to keep, we're not dedicated to the shiny toys that are out there. We got to be dedicated to actually building a worthwhile process. And so we've been having this conversation and I'm like, damn it. I was getting ready to do that. Son of a gun.
Ken Bett likes to put up the X symbol, right? On when he does talks and stuff, talking about how everything is ultimately a trade-off. All your decisions, you're trading off several things against several other things in a multi-dimensional manner. To me, it's about being comfortable with being uncomfortable. Because that's a recognition of, well, where are the tensions? Are you sensing those tensions? And are you making decisions knowing that, or are you making decisions completely ignoring that stuff? In which case, arguably, it's irrational or misguided.
When you were started talking about the CICD stuff, Franz, I thought about that. I forgot who said this quote, but I picked it up where it said, growth for growth's sake is the same ideology as cancer. Growing for the sake of growing is the same ideology as cancer. And yeah. We all know those companies that got too big for their britches, tried one too many things, you know, man's reach exceeding his grasp, Icarus, right? All those stories are old throughout all of history, right? And maybe, you know, we're lusting for something. And I think temperance or chastity is probably the perfect, you know, virtue to offset that, where Do we really, to your point, Franz, do we really need to do this? Do we really need to be able to deploy every time someone hiccups? Right? Like, the rational take on it, like, look, I know I'm excited and I want this thing, but do I really need this thing?
Yeah.
And how about on the strategy side of things? Because it's not just us techies being magpies and looking for the next shiny thing. It's also in the work that we do. It's in the features, the stories, the epics. You know, are we shoveling more and more features down the funnel without actually stopping to think, hang on, are these of value? Are these the right things to do? Are we lusting after the whales? You know, are we just trying to extract as much money out of a small set of users as possible? Back to a quote that Dave Snowden said about how Agile manages out innovation. Are we kind of lusting after one marketplace or one group of people rather than casting our nets wide and looking elsewhere, looking for new value?
It's not the craziest thing Dave said. I don't know that I agree with it, but it's not the craziest thing he said.
I wonder, though, so to your point, Sam, like, and back where left sits, right, in the world where there is, I mean, delusions of grandeur, right? Every company has them, but there is, hey, we have, everything is the number one. Everything is number one. Everything just has to get done. And that's a tough battle to fight because, I mean, once you reach a certain point in an organization, all you're worried about is the promises you made to someone else, right? When you climb that ladder, like left the junior VP is worried about a commitment he made to Merman, who's a senior VP, who's worried about a commitment that he made to some C-level, so on and so forth, right? And when you're worried about that sort of, that's your anchor, you're going to put it, you know, 10 pounds of stuff in the 5-pound bag and the delusional hope is, well, if I give Sam 10 things, we really only realistically can fit 5. Maybe I get lucky and he gets 7, which is a terrible way to manage. But we see it all the time. We see it all the time.
You know, what's funny is like, we think that these executives like can never be wrong and stuff. Like the higher up the ladder that we climb, the more we realize like senior and executive leaders, like they're not judged by their batting average. Like, they're like, hey, you tried for 5 things and you got 2 of them, you know, 5 big things this year and you got 2 of them, like, fantastic. And yet when they talk to their people, they act like, if we don't get all 5 of these things, I'm going to get fired and so will you all. And now I'm not saying they say those exact words, but that's the picture that's presented. And so if cards were always on the table about that, then people would not be freaked out and working nights and weekends to make these deliverables when they're not going to lose their job for not meeting this deadline. So why are they asking us to kill them for it?
So here's something that I've been struggling with currently about that statement. I always find it interesting when people work too much. And this is kind of the executive in me. So I'm going to put the executive hat on. I'm not asking any of my people to work too much. They take it upon themselves. And when I specifically say, I don't want you working past 6 o'clock, I see them responding to email. No matter how many times I've asked them not to do that, they still do it. What is the fear there, right? What are they lusting for? What are the blinders that is creating that experience? Because I'm not asking them to do that. I even, you know, I eat my own dog food. I try not to do that as well. I try not to send emails on weekends. So what is the lustful qualities within an organization that are creating those patterns, right? For people not to, maybe that's not lust. Maybe that's just straight up fear, which I think it is. But we've all been raised a certain way, right? From little kids, we've all been raised a certain way. And we bring that into work, right? And we bring that in. It's just our patterns. So how do we start to break down those patterns or habits in a way to know that I can trust that if I need somebody to work later, I'm going to let you know. I'm going to be like, yo, we got to rally, right? Circle the wagons, scramble the jets. We're in trouble. We got a production issue. We got to do it.
I think the main problem left is that when is not necessarily that like we see people doing that. It's when we see people be successful in doing that, right? Like the IT, you know, the IT director that, you know, worked, you know, we don't know what they've got going on at home. Maybe home life sucks. And so by responding to a few emails, they like get rid of some tension they have. Maybe someone's not in good health in their home. Maybe the way that they deal with, you know, emotional turmoil or stress at work is, well, fine, let me deal with these 2-3 emails so that I can sleep at night. But that's not the problem, right? The problem is that when we see someone do that and then become successful, and then they go, I became successful by doing all this. And they go on podcasts and write blog posts and speak at keynotes. And they're like, I busted my, you know, I worked nights and weekends. And, you know, this startup culture that we've just be like over glorifying and stuff. And like, so I think that is where that we see a natural desire of like, hey, I don't have anything to do, or I don't want to think about what's going on at home, so I'm going to respond to this work email because it gives me something to focus on that I can control or like. Because again, control is just a symptom of emotional discomfort. I'm experiencing emotional discomfort. I'm going to do something to do it. But when we see them be successful and then they glorify their story, well, then now I got to do that shit too.
Now, not for nothing, but some people do kind of enjoy working. Like, I like the projects that I'm on. If I think up something and go, oh, hey, I'm going to write this down, or I'm going to reply to something because I just had a little blip of inspiration, I'll do that on Sunday at 2. Like, if something comes up and I go, oh, my goodness, that one dumb issue we've been fighting with for the last 6 weeks, I just realize that we have to change. Like, I'm going to send out a message like, hey, guys, I figured this thing out. We're going to do this. We'll talk to you on Monday. So there is definitely an element of just, I like what I do, so I'll reply to emails. And I know that's not the same for everybody. There are definitely people who are like, if I don't hustle harder, right? Isn't that the
hustle culture thing phrase? Is kind of bizarre. It's really kind of bizarre.
It's a weird one. Like, I will say, and I don't want to get too distracted on the whole hustle culture, though, is I would rather have a bunch of people very excited about working hard productively and trying to generate value, again, our favorite agile phrase, generate value, than a bunch of people who are not doing anything. So I'd rather have a bunch of people who are maybe a little bit misguided and are working hard and they are creating something for themselves or others than a bunch of people who aren't. But I do think a large portion of the sending emails at 6 o'clock is probably people who are fairly passionate about their job. And the important thing there, though, is if they're going to be passionate, you got to make sure they have their work-life balance. And maybe that's where you talk to them. It's like, I know you dig your job. I know you're not doing this because you're scared. Oh, stop it, Chris. You know, you should be spending time with your kids. You're only going to get you're going to get 18 years with them. My email.
But you don't know what they got going on in their life. Like maybe like I got teenagers. My kids don't want anything to do with me except when they need money. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
so they're bothering you more, Chris.
But like, we're taking this down like a level of abstraction. Yeah. But I think I'm on the side of Chris. You never know what's going. So to me, it's like, I'm not going to tell you to go spend more time with your kids. What I'm going to tell you is, I don't like the pressure you're creating by constantly emailing over the weekend and after hours, right? You're setting a precedence, especially if you have privilege and rank. If you have privilege and rank and you're doing that, you're creating a habit that says, I need to now step up my game, or I need to create optics that I'm working.
And right? If you do and it I will and put get a, promoted, yeah. You're going to keep doing it.
Right. And I've built my career on the amount of work I've been able to produce. No cap, right? That is straight up. I became more successful because I worked harder than others, not smarter. Now I've learned to work smarter. Like, I put myself in the hospital with one job because I work so damn much. So I will say that, yes, you can move up the corporate ladder, but you'll hit a ceiling just like everything else. So it's not a sustainable way to work, right? It just puts you in an early grave, but that's a whole different topic.
What?
No, it's not. It's a really good point, actually, because if you go back to Dante's Inferno, the second circle of hell is where the lustful were punished. And how were they punished?
The whirling cyclone, right? Never stopping. Whirling cyclone. They never stop moving. Yeah.
Exactly. The restless and unreasoning wind of you're buffeted by an endless tempest. And that's exactly what you're describing there.
Yeah, a circle that never stops, which is, again, I think that goes back to our very beginning. Right. No, I'm saying like, but it's this, shut up, Sam. You're a hike away from me, but I'll get there eventually. I think the important part is like, I want off this crazy train. I want off this merry-go-round, right? Like, I think, so maybe that's the temperance that we're looking for, is like, as we're trying to land this plane, which I was very curious how we were going to land this freaking plane, is like, what is temperance, right? Temperance, to Sam, you know, for your illustration, is I want off. Whatever this is, I don't want it. Right. Like, I'm willing to say no thanks.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not going to give in.
You know what? I think we should bag it on that, because I'm not going to come up with anything witty on either of that. Let's just close on that one.
So what did we learn today, people? We learned that the opposite of being lustful is learning how to say no.
No is a complete sentence.
Do you know how many times I say
that? I use that all the time.
I quote, like, I say it and then I get mad that I quoted you for the 15th time that week. No is a complete sentence.
I even have the no button.
I even say it to my kids.
Yeah, but that's how Andrew gets to put on his executive hat, as he makes these cool quotes that everybody wants to keep using, right?
with skull and crossbones on his.
Yeah. Look at this fancy. I wore my executive fit today for everybody. I'm just letting you know. It's my fit check today. You're lucky I put on a shirt at all. I'm like sweating this fever out like big time. But I think through this whole series, what one thing we've all kind of alluded to is it's uncomfortable, right? There's a lot of uncomfortable things that come up, but I love that we're open and honest in talking through it. And if anything comes out of this series, and I don't mean to be kind of wooey or anything, is I hope this inspires others to have difficult conversations in a way that helps illuminate kind of the changes that need to happen, right? And how do we deal with the friction of these conversations or these sins? And I think it's really important that, especially as organizations try to harness this thing called change, that they're acknowledging that sometimes things just don't work that way, right? And how are we going to pivot with all the signals that are around us to use it, right? And not just abuse it, right? So if you had to break this down into binary, what are we going to use and what are we intentionally going to abuse to get there? I think that could be another interesting way. So there you go, another freebie for our listeners, a way to map kind of those things, right? You could do it as a blast radius or the use and abuse, right? I love real world terms that smack you in the face, and being abusive, that's a great one, right? So is lust creating abuse? Are we being abusive in our lust for change or lust for agile or lust for something?
Let's finish it up there then. So thank you very much all for listening to another episode of the Agile Uprising podcast. If you've enjoyed this, well, you clearly have, you've got this far, give us a like on all the various channels. If you didn't like it, you're probably not hearing this anyway, so it doesn't matter. From the panel, thank you very much. We'll see you next time. Bye.
Lev got the final word.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.